That's South Africa's Hugh Masekela with Tim Lela from his 1998 album Time. Born Hugh Ramopolo Masekela, he just actually celebrated his 75th birthday and became famous for his virtuosity on trumpet, flugelhorn, and cornet. He's also a composer and a singer and arranger and a major political activist, not only in his native South Africa, but all over the world. So, Tim Lela, to you too. This is Lead Stories. I'm Yatrice Lead. It is Tuesday, April the 8th, and I have a question for you. It's clear that we feel, as a group, we have a strong aversion to whatever is passing as politics today. It's no surprise. We've raised this question all the time among ourselves. What is this thing? What is this mess that passes for politics in the United States today? And in that regard, I don't think the United States is unique. I think all over the world, people are asking the same questions of their governments. What is this nonsense that we call government? Well, it's one thing to ask the question. It's another to find the answer. And I'm asking you today, what is the answer? What is the alternative to this mess? Or do you see that it is just incurable? We just need to have it die a natural death while we do something else? If so, then what is that something else? How do we cope with this system that whether we like it or not, it will go on? And the problem with that is it will continue to have inordinate impact on our daily lives. Even if we don't like it, it will control to a large degree what happens to us and what we do every single day. In one form or another, it will impinge our lives. It will crowd us out. It will overwhelm us. It will overtake us. What then is the answer? That's the question today to you. 888-874-4888. We have a note here from Nathaniel saying, hello to the Lead Story correspondent in Dallas and Berkeley. So we're getting wonderful feedback. By the way, I'm glad while you getting your calls ready. The feedback I've gotten from our first FYI by Harvey has been extremely positive, and I like that. And it was a way of just saying we have to trust that we can educate each other. There's so much of information available through the expertise we have gathered over the years, the experience that we have gathered over the years, and we can certainly pass it along to each other and encourage more inquiry, you know, get people excited about a topic. It doesn't have to be all, you know, mind-numbing, you know. But when you begin the process of sharing information, it's an extraordinary experience. So we will continue with the FYI, and I want to, again, thank Harvey for being our first flight balloon into that territory, and it worked very well. We'll have one coming up very shortly. I don't want to take the edge off of it, but it ought to be very interesting. So I'm hoping that we can get these FYIs going as regularly as possible. It's not a big deal, just under 10 minutes, 10 minutes and under. You take the time to do a mini presentation about a topic you think is worthy of extra special attention. And you let me know that you're interested, and you do that by sending me a note at leadstories@gmail.com, and you tell me that you're interested in doing something on whatever the subject matter might be, and I'll contact you and we'll go over some basic things as to, you know, how you might want to approach it. I won't tell you what to say, but I would tell you how to try and make it interesting so that people will continue to listen and react. It's also important to let us know what you think about the FYIs you're hearing. And again, we only heard one from Harvey. But as they go, it would be very important to get feedback. And some of you have done so. It is very, very important because it helps the presenter and it helps the program really, you know, raise the standards. We keep striving for more. From Connecticut, George, you're on the air.
Yeah, I'm wondering, Ms. Lead, if we could get that person back. That you had on that the fraudulent takeover of Detroit, because I think this has got to become a national issue. If we bring him on and bring some other people on, like I'm trying to think of his name, the economic hitman, people like that, maybe with him, people are going to realize that this is a banking and the New World Order, or whatever you want to call these groups of these oligarchs that are trying to take over the cities illegally through criminal masters. If we can uncover exactly how they're doing this, they're doing this different, slightly different methods, but basically the same technique everywhere. And we've got to realize if we don't stop them at Detroit, they'll try it on every city, every state, and even the country itself.
Well, actually, I thank you for that. It is, in fact, as you just said, it is a national issue. And that is why, you know, I concentrated on making sure that we keep abreast of what's going on in Detroit, because it has implications for the entire nation. I will be doing some future programs on cities that are on the brink of going the same way, being forced into bankruptcy. And then, of course, it's open to being raped and pillaged by the banks, you know. This is how it's going. There are several cities. At last count, I think I counted about 40 cities are on the brink of going the route of Detroit. The thing I liked about it, I got a wonderful, wonderful email about it just yesterday. It was just so overwhelmingly positive, you know, in the reaction, that I had to take more time to read it again. But essentially, the writer said that the coverage of Detroit opened his eyes about the very thing that you were just saying, that it finally dawned on him that these things may seem to be isolated, but when we start connecting the dots, we see how these the banksters are moving. They are moving as a gang.
Well, this has been going on long before it's been reported, but people who know this generally are afraid to lose their jobs, like in the IMF and places like that. I've talked to a number of people because I used to be in the international community, and this is a very open secret that they've been doing this to countries. They basically test out the same technique. They get away with it because most people don't study finance and economics, and even if they do, they don't understand this because most of the stuff they learn in college is totally a waste. It's propaganda. They don't get down to the brass tacks. I mean, be honest with you. Our great-grandparents had a better handle on this with a sixth-grade education because they've had their that's why they came here. They got screwed from everywhere else. They saw it going on, and they knew what exactly is going on. I mean, the people who have a doctorate degrees, many of them don't have as much understanding of the issues that our great-grandparents' sixth-grade education had.
That's very true. Thank you, George. Thanks for calling.
You're...
Well, Green from Baltimore, what have you to say? What is the alternative to the political system that we have now, you think?
Oh, see, now you want the alternative. I was prepared to answer what was going on, but I've got an answer for that, too. But first of all, how are you?
Fine. I'm hanging in.
Fantastic.
I'm hanging in there.
That's good.
Thank you.
You know, I appreciate your show because you bring information about things that are happening around the country that people in, you know, that aren't situated in that area might not know about. I'd like to share something with you and your listeners.
Go ahead.
Okay. March 4th Eddie Marshall Conway was released from, I think it was Maryland State Penitentiary. When he was 23, he was Minister of Defense of the Baltimore chapter of the Black Panther Party, and many of us feel that he was framed for the murder of a policeman and the shooting of another. And he spent 43 years and 11 months in the Maryland State Penitentiary as a result of the COINTELPRO program. And anyway, like I said, he was released March 4th due to a Supreme Court decision. And I think it was a day of celebration for people in Baltimore, in the state of Maryland, and it should be for the entire country. But, okay. Now, the solution, I've been talking about the solution to this all the time. First, you know, what is the problem? People, you know, when we go to school, we're taught political, you know, we might take political science, and they have a very complicated definition of that. But I think very simply it could be stated that politics is relationships between people or groups of people or any combination of people and groups. And political science would be the study of who has power, how, when, where, and how. Or how, when, where, and yeah, how, where, and when. What we see going on now is the same old thing of people positioning themselves for power. For example, in the Ukraine right now, what's going on is the attempt of the United States and Europe to gain will be the most powerful group, and especially America, in the world. And so you have people who are on the offense and people who are pushing back, and they're on the defense.
So what is the alternative in your view?
Okay, well, for us, and I'm only concerned about black people. It's not that I have no compassion for other people, but I feel that our plight is the most dire in the world, all over the world, for black people. And I think that, first of all, we should understand that our struggle is for the salvation of black people. We should not feel that we have to save America or any other group, because America can take care of itself. Other groups are taking care of themselves. Our survival should be job number one, actually the only job, I think, for black folk. And I was very elated by Clara's call yesterday. Even though she didn't understand what I was saying, Clara. Clara gets it. I think Sarah does too, and some of your other callers. The problem we have is that too many of us feel that we're beholden to America. And so we can't, like the Urban League, like the people in the Urban League.
But you're taking us to the philosophical realm. I'm interested in what is, based on where you are, what is the alternative? What is the system going to look like? What will it do?
Well, we have to build our own systems and our own institutions. For example, in Baltimore, there are a few schools that are black-oriented, and they teach our children, because education is more than just learning skills. It's also the transference from one generation to another of history, traditions, culture, and loyalties.
Okay, and so build your own institutions. That's your solution.
Right. And I said once before, considering the amount of money that passes through the hands of black people, we should be building our own economy. And, of course, for us to do anything on our own, we're going to meet resistance. And we have to be prepared to meet that resistance. But we have to be firm in the idea that we have to do this for black people.
All right. That's your view. Let's see what people think of it. Thank you very much for calling, Green. From New Jersey, Alex, you're on the air. What is the alternative to whatever it is that's happening now? Oh, he's not there anymore. 888-874-4888. We talk all the time about how badly the system is functioning and literally penalizing people. You don't get a sense that there is this healthy relationship between the governed and those who are governing. And it's before our eyes every day. So what is the alternative? Is it just to check out of the system? Even if you do, it will still affect you. So is it pointless to even think that you could change it? Or do you think that you can within certain very closely circumscribed circumstances, you can do something about it? If so, what would that be? We are, after all, a society, and society has some kind of structure, some kind of power equation between who gets to govern and who is governed. So let me hear about your ideas about what might be an alternative. Michael from New Jersey.
Hi, Utrice. Thank you for taking my call.
Thank you for calling.
I think one of the big problems is that politics is transactional and it's based on power as it is now. And power comes from money as it is now. So I think, firstly, we have to get money out of politics. It's got to be the will of the many versus and not the will of the money.
How do you do that when there is overwhelming evidence that they have the power to resist exactly what you just said?
Well, we have to put our heads together and somehow, because this came about mostly through the Supreme Court, where they said money is speech. So there is something move to amend. You've got to reverse that. We have got to reverse that. We cannot go on saying money is speech and expect to have a democracy. We're quickly moving towards fascism, and that's when money and power get together and corporations have the money, and that's where we're going with this. Unless we can, I think that we should put all our efforts into getting money out of politics. So, why can't we just have, as a first step, just completely complete public financing of elections with no soft money, no hard money, no PACs, no contributions. So that there's a representation not of money but of people.
Now, I'm thinking as you said that, I thought of two things, snowball and hell.
Well, yeah, because this has had a lot of momentum. There has to be a radical change of course because, this has had precedent in the courts. It's had political precedence through the law, et cetera, et cetera. And there's a very basic thing here that people have said that, politics is power, power is money, and so this is how it's distributed, et cetera, et cetera. So maybe we got also number two, after we get money out of politics, we have to get politicians out of government.
Okay.
Replace the politicians with, now we have technology, let's replace the politicians with technology. So they become extinct politicians because we've gotten to the point with machines, computers, where their jobs can be replaced. Now, that will get the graft and the corruption, and you have, right now, as I talked about Dianne Feinstein, you have politicians going to work with the Wall Street Journal and the Financial Times, and whose interests are they, whose interests do they have at heart? Their own and their constituents who are giving them money and I mean, brokers on Wall Street go to work with the Wall Street Journal and the Financial Times, and this is what you have in government. The politicians are going to work with the Wall Street Journal and the Financial Times. They don't have anybody's interest except those powerful people who maintain their power. So then, if you're going to have people in government at all, I think it mostly should be computers, because I think we have the technology now.
And who's going to control the computers?
Well, here it is. I think the people that you get in there that have to control the computers should be people who have given up all worldly interests.
Oh, my Lord.
And
they are
the only ones who are qualified to serve the needs of the people.
All right. Well, you put your case out. Let's see how people react to it. From Los Angeles, John, you're on the air.
Hi, Patrice. Long-time listener. And
thank you.
I listen to you. I enjoy your program tremendously, especially Sarah and some of the other contributors. And I do listen to your program for Afrocentric point of view because I find it's lacking quite a bit, as you say. So I want to get your take on Al Snitch Sharpton.
Oh, that the story that they thought they broke today, that story?
Yes.
That he was basically wearing a wire for the FBI. That was old news back in the 1980s.
Oh, I see. Okay. Well, thank you for that. And I didn't know that. Do you want to elaborate on that a little bit
yes.
further?
There was a time in the 1980s in New York City, we had quite a lot of different kinds of stories that placed Al Sharpton in the middle of a lot of controversial cases. And, you know, I've known him for more than 30 years. And I've known Al Sharpton to be many, many different things. At that time, he was very much into the grassroots movement. And there was, in fact, and he confirmed it, there was a time when he was said to be wearing a wire for the FBI, but they did not say it at the time that it was connected to organized crime, as in the mafia, but it was, they raised the specter that he was in fact spying in the black community on many of the black leaders that he was affiliated with. It did a lot of damage to him, but he finally did say that he was wearing a wire, and it was because he was trying to destroy or to basically put out of business a syndicate, a drug syndicate that was operating in the African-American community, especially Bedford-Stuyvesant. So he did come forward with that as an explanation. It hasn't all gone away since then. It always was looming over him. But the story that they're breaking today, it's an old story. Been there, done that.
Okay, well, thanks for that.
You're welcome. You know, not too long ago I had somebody discuss the Fourth Amendment, that Snowden has made the Fourth Amendment relevant. I had to remind them. That happened in 1957, when the African-American woman whose home was invaded by police without a warrant had to literally fight her way through court. And then we got the Fourth Amendment asserting or just re-emphasizing the need that citizens should be protected against unreasonable searches and seizures. But the case was Mapp versus Ohio. The Supreme Court didn't decide that until 1961, but that case was still 1957, and the African-American community was discussing that issue back then. So it was kind of surprising to me today that this story surfaced again as news. We were there back in the 80s. That's like an early 1980s story. Thanks for your call. From Los Angeles, DX, you're on the air.
Hello, Utrees. How are you today?
Good. How about you?
I'm doing fine. Thanks for asking. On the subject of the governmental system that we have, before I go to the answer of what I think we should do about it and what should happen, I think it's crucial to identify precisely what the problem is. Now, a caller called before and said that the situation in Detroit, if we don't do something about it, it's going to spread to other cities and maybe it's going to happen to the whole country. Well, I got news. It's already been done to the whole country because what we're living in right now, I mean, they've been up to this for decades, but what happened in 2001 when that tragic event happened, after that, basically our whole government was taken over in a coup. And it's been in the same hand since, and things are just going to get worse and worse. So we need to identify the problem. The problem...
Could you explain what happened in 2001?
Well, I mean, they had been on this track that they're on for a long time. Now, they needed a big event in order to just snatch control.
And who were they?
Well, if you let me, I'll explain it to you.
Okay. I'll shut up. I got your hint. I shall shut up and have you address the situation.
To cut to the chase, kind of, they, amongst others, the major they is the banks. Because like the caller said before, this is a bank takeover in Detroit. The bankers, they are the ones who are primarily doing this. And they use basically the same template for each place they try to do this at with. And so this has already happened. They're just going city by city now because what they're doing is they're working down from federal government down to the states, down to the cities, down to the towns. And that's why I've said it many times on your show that local is the only local elections and local politics are the most effective place we can have a foothold because they're doing this from the top down, which is very, very atypical, I would think. I would think that's atypical because you would think they would work from the bottom up. But we already have bankers in control of the country, basically. And the reason why is because, for one thing, everything in our monetary system, first of all, well, everything is based on our monetary system, including our government, because you need millions of dollars to get elected, point number one. So, so that shows that everything is around the monetary system, and we live in a monetary system that, for one thing, is not fair. It's very, very we have nothing but vultures. It encourages bad actors. I mean, this is the problem. That's the number one problem.
A question to you, though.
Yeah.
If, as you say, it is a top-down system, and that they already have established that they are in control of it at that level. If they can control it at the top-down level, the national level, why would they not be as effective at the local level?
Well, it's what I say all the time, that federal elections, we're going to use elections, federal elections are controlled by big money already. You see, so who has more money than the bankers? So at the local level, and I've given examples of this, you don't need as much money. You can go door to door in your town. You can walk the streets and directly contact people. You don't need really TV advertising or anything like that, even in some city races. So that's a part of it that they cannot control, and they already have analyzed this, I believe, from the beginning, that they can't control that necessarily.
I think they have in many instances.
Well,
they have backed, you know, in districts where it doesn't take that much to run a candidacy for any particular office, how often have we seen that they have these straw candidates, they put a lot of money behind them, And invariably, you know, it's not that they most often win, but invariably quite a few do win.
Right. Well, I was going to say that in some major cities and some districts that include major cities, I presume when you say districts, you're talking about the federal representatives and senators, or representatives, correct?
I'm talking about everything, city council, state level, and or county level, and congressional level.
Well, I didn't say they have no influence at all in any district, but I would say that it's not as pronounced as it is by a long shot as it is federally, is what I'm saying. So independent candidates and Green Party and socialist candidates can still be effective, and I've given examples of that. So that's the first part of the problem. The second part of the problem, I'm trying to go through quick so I can give someone else a chance to go. But the second part of the problem, as I see it, is that they try to make everything, and this is where the media comes in and the whole school system, and they try to make it seem like politics is very complicated and it's hard and elections are hard to do and hard to win and you need this and you need that. Also, they do the same thing with monetary issues, with the banking system, look at how they try to make it, oh, well, you would never understand that because it's very complicated. We need these experts on Wall Street who went to Harvard or wherever that have this Armani suits on to figure this out. It's way over your head. So just be quiet and sit down over there. See, they have that kind of condescending mentality towards the people. So that's part of the problem as well, along with, like I said, the schooling system and also putting a fluoride in the water. I mean, I hate to bring that up, but just Google it if people don't know what I'm talking about. It's used to make people quiet and subdued, and they use it in, what's the medicine they give to children with ADD? They use key ingredient.
Ritalin?
Right. So they got us coming and going. Ritalin.
Yeah.
So they got us coming and going, and it's a multi-level thing they have going on here, and they've thought this out very, very, very carefully from decades and even years and even centuries ago. So anyway, let's get to the solution. Okay, so I believe in two words, I can sum it up, and then I'll expound a little bit. The solution to me, self-governance. Now, we tend to think that because of what I just went through and explained, we tend to think that it's hard to govern ourselves or it's too complicated. It is not. It is not. We have examples of this. When I give examples of this, I like to bring up my favorite economist, Richard Wolff, Dr. Richard Wolff. I don't know if you know who he is, but he's a socialist Marxist economist who believes in self people running the economy themselves. So he, on his show, he gives examples of what he calls WSDEs.
And those he comes on right after me today, actually.
Oh, okay. So maybe he's listening right now. So I love that guy. He talks about what are called WSDEs, worker self-directed enterprise. And the biggest example in the world is the Mondragon Corporation in Spain, I believe, and they have thousands of employees, and they run the company themselves, and there's none of that CEO getting 400 times what the average worker gets or any of that. They govern themselves. I mean, they govern the workplace themselves. So I would say self-governance, but we first have to get out of that mentality that we don't know how to do it, because we do. All we have to do is awaken. We have so many people who believe in advocating for the people who know how this can be done a different way. So we just have to awaken people around us if we can and try to make it happen. And the other thing I would take issue with one of the callers, I believe, or maybe it was you, is that the system is going to keep existing. It's going to just keep going. It's going to be there. I don't think so. I think this is end game, and they're making sure that the wealthy end up keeping everything they have and they're taking everything from everybody else. I believe this is end game. This is the end of this whole governing system, the monetary system in this country. This is the end. It's over. Those jobs, the jobs are not coming back. The security that you have with your home ownership and all of that is not coming back. It's over. So we need to think of something, get together quick, and have a system ready to go when this does completely fail. So I'm not going to take up any more time.
No, but that, I mean, quite instructive. You see how people think. Many different points of view are before us today for consideration. What are you thinking? 888-874-4888. You know, until you start talking with people and you get these ideas that are circulating, they have been cogitating on these things for quite a while, and they have their unique ways of interpreting the real world that surrounds them. So it may vary from place to place, but generally, I think people have a sense that whatever it is that we are calling a government today, or just government across the board, local, state, and federal, there is a pervasive view that this thing called government is just not working. It's producing really very bad results. It is impeding progress in the larger sense. It's, of course, making a lot of people very, very wealthy. And along with that, an attitude. I was referring to it as a zero-sum attitude, which is anything good is not to be shared by anyone, everyone. You're not entitled to be prosperous. You're not entitled to a good education. All these things have to be legislated specifically to apportion your specific amount of whatever that good is that should come to you, and it will always come with all these conditions. Government has become so mean. It has become so anti-human. And you wonder whether there is any hope in an organization called government when people think this way. They've reached that place where they can sleep at night with these kinds of inhumane decisions that they make. From Dallas, it's Sarah. How are you?
Oh, greetings to you, Yutrif.
Thank you.
And greetings to the PRN audience. Yutrif, when it comes to politics, and everybody know my little rant when it comes to this thing and called politics and electoral politics anyway, we're going to have to do you, Trees, and self-segregate yourself and just be a community within a community. And we see this has existed and worked for several other ethnic communities. You see it with the Jewish community, the Asians, and all other communities who are a broader part of the U.S. economy, but yet still they are self-segregated within themselves, where they provide their own schooling, they have their own language base, they have their banks, businesses that they support for themselves. Black people are going to have to get back into that mode of doing things, because we used to be that way at one point in time, and for the past 60 years, we have been on this downward suicidal mission that we've been on, of not wanting to take responsibility and go back into doing what it is that we were doing. The civil rights movement and these leadership that we've had, they have sold us this bill of goods that we can expect handouts, that begging is the new way of us getting what we want, begging, shaming, and maybe embarrassing corporations, and that's how we're going to get sustenance. And that mode is all played out. It worked for a few people at the top of the chain, but it's not trickling down to the bottom, and we need to stop. We need to get off our knees, stop the begging, do as the Chinese did, as you said, in New York alone, where they have Chinatown, and they have all of these newspapers that they have around. You go everywhere in Chinatown, they're all self-segregated. You see they have the Chinese character that they have on all of their businesses, on their streets, everything. They are a community within a broader nation. No one is bothering them. No one is telling them that they can't do it. But it's some or the other when it comes to black people. We're the only ones who are told that it is wrong, and we run around with this image that if we want to self-segregate, then something is wrong with us, and we need to stop it. It is ludicrous, Utri. It is ludicrous to think like that.
I want to challenge you on the same.
Yes,
many
ma'am.
People in Chinatown are, in fact, living horribly poor lives. They're not, in fact, part of the wealth of Chinatown. Most of the people in Chinatown are poor. They're working poor and poor.
I understand that. I understand that they have a problem there with child labor laws, as well as where they're bringing a lot of immigrants who are undocumented workers, et cetera, from China, Hong Kong, and Taiwan that they have in there working there. But if you look at the broader picture, in all communities, you're going to find corruption at the bottom, where people exploit others in order to make their wealth. But what I'm saying as a general rule is that they have self-segregated themselves in order to build themselves up, to make themselves something to be reckoned with. Black people, we're going to have to look around at a model to see that we cannot just say we're going to go out here. And I always use the analogy of a jungle setting. You have all of these animals in a jungle setting. You have the elephants, the tigers, the leopards, and all of that. They're all living in this big jungle, but they each self-segregate themselves. You don't see the giraffes hunting to feed the lions and the leopards, etc. They all take care of themselves, even though they all live in this big place. And black people are the only group of people who like to tell ourselves that if we try to do for ourselves, that we are hating or we are doing something to hurt somebody. No, it's not. Me loving me don't mean to say I hate somebody else. I hate white people or whatever. It has nothing to do with that. My emotions don't have nothing to do with that. We need to stop playing these games, using these buzzwords about you hating or you jealous. It has nothing to do with that. I don't know anybody to be hating on them. It's a waste of my time to be sitting around here fuming and hating on somebody. That's not going to do anything for me. It's just that because you talk a certain way and people always want to take it on, want to get childish and say you are hating. You're not hating. You are stating a fact that in order for you to survive, you're going to have to depend on yourself. Any community who are dependent on somebody else to take care of them, they're already a doomed society. You are doomed. You're not going to survive because okay. We're already seeing in this economy the way how things are going. Everybody is scrambling to take care of themselves, and the black people are the only ones out here letting these politicians, letting these religious leaders tell us that we need to depend on the government, we need to depend on politicians. No, you don't. You have handicapped ourselves. We've handicapped ourselves for the past 60 years. We have distorted Dr. King's message. We have let people take out a few buzzwords here and there, put it completely out of context, and have you stuck in a doggone dream when the other part of this message was about reparations, about what the government that they owe to us. As Dr. King said in his speech, you treat the speech that he was going to make on the day before he was killed. It was the Sunday at Ebenezer. It was why America might just go to hell. That was a speech he was going to talk about. He was saying when he go to Washington on the People's March, it was that he was coming to get the check. He wasn't talking about, you know, we're going to sit back and we're going to hold hands and I want my children to live in some dream. That was not Dr. King. They like to keep this man stuck in 63, but they don't want to bring him forward to 68.
Okay, well, you laid your case out. Thanks a lot.
You're
Thanks
welcome,
so
Yutri.
Thank you. Ali from New York. You're on the air.
Reese, how are you doing?
Fine, thank you.
I just heard a few people talking about self-government, and to me, it's almost, I had to laugh about that, because United States government not only control the citizen of the United States, they control the citizen of their places. Like, the Venezuela tried to do self-government, so the Hondurans, they tried to do self-government. And what did they do to President Zelaya? They did a coup d'etat. And who approved that coup d'etat? The United States. So therefore, how are people talking about self-government? One of the hardest things is to bring people together, to gather them, and go out there and protest. I belong to different groups here in New York City. And one of the things that we are fighting for is $15 an hour. And you have to see the same people that they start this fight are the same people that they go out there every time. Our next protest at Herald Square will be on April 12th at 3 o'clock. And I'm going to tell you, it's the same people out there fighting for the same thing. it's very, very hard to get people to go out there and fight. What can be done to change this government, I have no idea, because a lot of the people are very, very afraid. Anytime that you talk to people over the phone, people think that they're being recorded, that they've been listened to, and one day they're going to be knocking on the door to take us away. And it probably will happen. But you look what's happening in Ukraine right now. So if you even think about immigrating into another country, because maybe things will be better, we're just fooling ourselves. What they're doing in Ukraine is the same thing that they're doing in Detroit, isn't it?
So what's the alternative that you suggest, Ali?
Well, right now, like I say, I'm a fighter. I'm out there with different groups in New York City. I'm part of a Stop Mass Incarceration. I'm part of Occupy. And I just trying to do my work with those groups, the little that I could do. So what is the alternative if we don't get together? And they I remember the government have the ammunition. So even if we get together, they will be out there waiting for us. You have to see, on Friday we went down to the veteran memorial and filed the veterans got arrested, and you have to see, we were there about 10 o'clock at night. You have to see the amount of cops out there for this little group of people. So what is the alternative? I don't know. We have to think about that. But as long as, like Sarah was saying, each group is pulling on themselves, and we don't get together, it will be very, very hard. We need people's power. We need to get together to fight together. And I don't see that happening right now. Thank you.
Thank you, Ali. Very profound. Thank you so much. Well, the conversation will continue as we chug along because, of course, this is the midterm election year, and you'd notice a kind of twist in the tempo of politics and a very clear attempt to force us to focus on what they think is important. What do we think is important? And to what degree, just like Ali said, to what degree are we investing in the things that we say we think would work? These are questions. Ali says, again, what is the answer? We don't know yet. Many of us don't know what the answer is, and there may be 20 different answers, but it's time to begin talking about it. This is not a right or wrong thing. It's about just thinking it out, thinking it through, talking with people and exchanging the ideas to let us know that this thing that we are trapped into doesn't have to work this way. We know we don't like the way it's working. We can see that the results are not the best results. So we ought to be thinking about something else that would work and putting it together to make sure that, in fact, it does work. That's where we have to go with it. And if we achieve just that, this conversation where people are thinking about it, that's great. That's a great, great start. Tomorrow we'll be talking about third parties and the peculiar history of third parties in the United States. I hope you'll tune in tomorrow. It will be a very, very vigorous discussion. Again, I want to thank you for your consistent effort at offering your best thoughts on this program, and bravely so. You know, I think people basically, this is an intimate act of sharing your thoughts with people. You know, it's not an easy thing to do, but you very, very brave folks. And I really not only appreciate it, but I also appreciate what's behind it, that you trust that your thoughts will be handled very well and with great respect here on this program. So stay tuned. Coming up next is Richard Wolff. with Economic Update. We'll see each other tomorrow. Bye-bye.